It's retro ramble time with a difference. A few of our guests have asked to do it over the internet, which we're more than happy to do. However, we have had to go through a learning curve with Riverside and weird volume issues. Please stick with us while we get things right. Over to you, Tom.
Welcome back to A Retro Rambles. And the first thing you're going to notice is I am in my office. And you may only notice that because it's not going to sound like we're walking around somewhere. Long and the short of it is we've had more guests come forward and say, if we could do it remotely, then brilliant. And I'm going to run with that. We're still going to be rambling. We're just not going to be rambling while we're rambling. So the first person that we had was obviously Rob. We've then had Mr. Biffo for episode 2. And this is episode 3. And I'd like to extend my hand in welcome to Nikki. Say hello, Nikki.
Hello.
So, Nikki, just for people that are listening, where may people have come across you before and what do you do?
Oh, boy.
Just throw it all at you in one go.
Me and my wife used to do a YouTube channel, Nikki and Bunty, where we just did really stupid videos about video games and other stuff. We reached the dizzying heights of 400 subscribers, which is amazing.
I'm going to say now, you deserved so many more. And of course, this is where I discovered it. I came across yourselves way back in the day and all kind of around the origins of the Digitizer YouTube and the Digitizer Live show and then Cheap Show Live and all of that. And that's kind of how I discovered you. And I've been following and part of your various communities since.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. That's what we started doing. Originally, a bit of trivia. Originally, the channel was called Two Girls, One Video Editor.
Nice reference.
You know, that sets the tone. And we do streams on Friday nights where just a bunch of us get together. And it's usually one of us playing a game and the other one talking absolute nonsense. Like last week, Emma was playing Yakuza. And I was making up James facts about James Corden, true facts about James Corden.
Any that come to mind?
None that I can repeat.
Okay, so they're that sort of fact. Okay.
I don't know how litigious he is. So.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm guessing the fat git is probably very litigious. And I hate James Corden. I'm sure I've brought this up on the show before. I cannot stand the man. And when I heard he was going to America, I thanked the Lord so much and hoped that he would never come back. But he keeps coming back. So, yeah.
That's kind of what we do. Recently, like the past couple of years, I've been developing a video game, which has been running around my head for, oh, goodness, at least 5 or 6 years. Like, wanted to make this story in some form. So that's another place people might have seen me around on social media, the game Quantum Witch. That's basically stupid streams, stupid videos, and games with small pixelated dancing skeletons.
Which is exactly as it should be. I mean, you know me, I'm very much about the whole retro gaming, and I am, as our listeners already know, very much stuck in the 90s. I was born in the 80s, and I've not really left the 90s as... No. I mean, obviously the listeners can't see, but you can see Mr. Cadbury Parrot hiding behind my head over there. So.
Yes.
So, and there's various boglins and all stuff behind me. And in fact, I can just about see the gladiators over my shoulder as well. Original gladiators, bear in mind.
So, oh, of course.
It's the only way. But that your content has always kind of been so much fun and a real mix of not just modern game, but the retro stuff. And then Quantum Witch has come along. And when I first saw the screenshots of it, and it's just, it's absolutely beautiful pixel art to me. It really is gorgeous. You've written it in Java, haven't you, if I remember rightly, or have you, is that
so I started writing off in JavaScript for easy deployment But then I got some advice that it would never, ever, ever run on consoles like that.
Right, okay.
So I took about a month to learn C# and port it all to Monogame. So now it's in a format where it'll potentially, if we get funding and a publisher to get it over to the consoles, like Xbox, PlayStation, Switch, it'll go on any of them.
Okay, that's awesome to hear. I mean, the fact that it only took you a month to kind of transfer your skills from kind of scripting through to C# is incredible. I mean, the coding I do has always been, the first language I learnt was Delphi. It was Quick Basic, actually, but then Delphi, because it came free on a copy of a PC Shopper, I think it would have been. And then that kind of became VB.net, and that's where I've stayed. I've never been able to pick up C or anything vaguely relating to C. Know why. It's just like a wall in front of me.
I think I started in QBasic. No, mm-hmm. I didn't know. That's a pointless and transparent lie. I started off on Spectrum Plus 3. And excuse me one moment. And I'm not a big outdoors person, so it was a summer I spent indoors with a Spectrum Plus 3 manual learning BASIC. And that's where I started.
See, they were the good old days. You go to your local library, you had all those fantastically illustrated books with right on 70s, kind of 80s drawings on the front. You open them, it's like, if you've got a BBC Micro, go to page 10. If you've got a Spectrum ZX, go to page 12. Yeah. And then there'd be the code list, and you spend your day typing it. And then you spend the next day trying to find where you went wrong typing it before you realised you'd done the Commodore 64 BASIC rather than the BBC BASIC and whatever else it would be. And then you'd get a lovely little pixel appear on the screen and that would be it. But that was enough. It got you really into, like, wow, I did that.
Yeah, it was... I mean, yeah, some of my earliest and best memories are the Spectrum. It really captured my imagination that I could just create these whole worlds in the computer. Mm. And, you know, I'd write a little text adventure or something and I'd get to the end of it and think, oh, it's no good. You know, nobody's going to want to play it because, I knew it. I'd written it. I knew every twist and turn in it. And to me, there was no point playing. But I'd give it to members of my family and they'd spend a long time just sat there like exploring because they have no idea what's there and to them it's a whole new world to discover and sorry, like my first gaming memory, sorry, I'm getting onto your questions here.
No,
just
that's
doing
fine.
It seamlessly, like a professional.
That was the point. So you know what the six questions are. The listeners know what the six questions are. But we'll go straight into that first one. What was your first gaming memory? It's go for it.
Trash Man on the Spectrum.
An interesting choice.
Yeah, it was a friend had a Spectrum Plus 2, and it's family friends. Everybody was around their house. I didn't want to be socializing, so I went and what can we do with this computer thing?
Yeah.
And a load of Trash Man. And it really was like this whole self-contained, cohesive world of a Trash Man in the computer, and it just captured my imagination in ways that other media hadn't, because other media wasn't interactive like that. You know, I could go into the houses and listen, speak to the people and make decisions. I was in control of this.
Well, ultimately, it was pretty open world for the era. When you consider what it was and what was actually available and the power behind what was actually giving you that game, it was surprisingly involved.
Yeah. Like Paperboy. You're just going up the road and you're throwing the papers and you've got your little obstacle course at the end. But on this one, there's decisions to be made. You know, would you go and help the guy fix his TV or would you run and keep up with the truck? And, just absolutely captured my imagination. And that was the moment I knew that I loved games and I wanted to create these worlds as well.
That's absolutely amazing to hear. And what always makes me chuckle a bit here is I'm looking forward to getting my first American guest, because so far, almost every British person I've spoken to has basically said Clive Sinclair introduced them to gaming and computers.
Yes.
He has a lot to blame.
Absolutely.
But those little black obelisks of, well, not even obelisks, those little black tablets of old school microchips and rubber chiclet keyboards really, really did bring an entire generation of people into not just the gaming world, but the programming world. And dare I say, there's probably people of similar ages to us now that really wouldn't have been into data science, wouldn't have been into business analysis, wouldn't be into infrastructure, into software development, without having been introduced at such a young age to incredibly low power machines when you consider what they were.
The difference with them was the manual. It just, it told you everything. It was like, you've bought this piece of hardware and the hardware is yours, and here is everything you can do with it. And how to do it, and you could go from nothing to, you know, writing games and selling games just with that manual, that manual and your imagination. And there was a brief period, you know, when PCs were more popular, but the internet hadn't really taken off, that we'd lost that. You know, these things didn't come with a manual; they didn't tell you how to program them. And now we're in the age of the internet, so you can learn anything. You have to 5 seconds on a search engine, you found how to do it.
Well, that's it. I've got a 10-year-old girl upstairs going to bed right now, and she's learning at school and has learned at school how to use Scratch, which is absolutely fantastic. And she's used the BBC Micro bit and learned how to program those. And they're such important skills that I don't think I ever really thought about growing up until now, realising I learnt those back then.
Yeah, like our daughter's, she's going to be 14 in February. Oh my goodness, I'm too young to have a 14-year-old. I'm not.
We all
I'm
say that.
I'm still 14 in my head. But yeah, she's taught herself Blender.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, and now she's got, she's selling animations and accessories on Roblox. I want to do this. I'll go on YouTube and type in Blender tutorial, and she's done it herself. It's great. How it should be.
That is exactly as it should be. I mean, we've gone from the days now that you loaded up a game on your Speccy, on your Commodore, on your Amstrad, your Acorn, whatever you had, and the first screen you got was the publisher saying, "We need games. If you write games, send them to us and we might publish it for you."
Yeah.
That world has disappeared. Now, actually, kids don't realise how lucky they are. I mean, I've played Roblox a little bit with my girl, and there's a few games that genuinely are fun. But the fact that they've made it open source and that you can go away, and if you want to learn, they provide all the resources for you to do it. It's a really nice thing. It's so unusual now when you consider everything is about making money, yet really teaching one of our children to make a game in Roblox probably isn't going to make them any money, but it's going to teach them some really important skills if they want to take that forward.
Yeah. I mean, she's doing accessories for a pretty niche community, but she's going niche. She's really leaning into the niche, and it's Invader Zim. As you know, good parents that we are, we introduced her to Invader Zim.
Of course.
And yeah, she loves it, and she's found a community of Invader Zim fans online who've got their Roblox servers and games stuff. So she's doing little, you know, Gurr masks and Erkin antenna accessories that people are buying. And just the information's out there. It's the same type of potential as we saw in Spectrum with that manual. It's like, this is how to do it. go create.
Exactly.
It's an amazing thing.
And I mean, it would be a very unusual moment for someone listening to this who said, well, actually, I'm not a gamer or a computer person. But let's say you are a gamer, but you've never thought about programming. The closest thing I can really think of that is outside of the computer world to this is if you went and bought a 1995 registered Nissan Micra and you look in the Nissan book that came with it, you would learn so much about that car, what to do, and if you opened up the bonnet, you could see what you needed to do. Comparing that now to a modern car, if you go out and look at my Renault out on the road, for example, I can open up the bonnet. I can't get to jack shit on that, and the manual doesn't tell me anything because they don't want you doing it yourself anymore. And that's what we're trying to say here. The Speccy, the Commodore, they're books, as you said, their guides, their instruction manuals weren't just, this is how you load a game, this is how you turn it on. It really was, this is how it works, this is how the keyboard works, and then, boom, here's some code, learn it. This is what all of the references do. And it's sorely missed. It really is sorely missed.
Yes, by the time I'd got into, left school, I'd already got a grounding in, the basics of software. And it was that's what I based my career on. It was a career that really suited me because I didn't really have to talk to that many people. I just got given requirements and made the computer go beep at the right times. So that was my first gaming memory. My first computing memory was an Acorn. I think Acorn Electron with an amber screen. And I did what any kid with my sense of humour would do, and I typed the word knickers into it. And then panicked because I thought, if my dad sees that I've typed knickers into this, he won't let me use it. And pulled the plug immediately.
Oh, the days when you could just pull the plug on a computer and not worry about anything being broken, about hard drives coming to a sudden stop, or, oh my gosh, what an era. Okay, that was your first gaming memory. Well, let's move on. Now, I will say, we'll keep to actually the terminology here. What was the first console either you were bought or you bought? And I am going to leave that up to you because I think a lot of people that are listening might think, well, because of particular age groups, they're going to be very similar systems. And A, that's not always very true. But B, I will leave it open to with whether you choose the one you were bought or you bought, because that gives a much wider range of dates then. Because I know the first console I actually bought myself was the original Xbox. And that's because I was working at Game On release night and we got an amazing discount on it. Prior to that, the only thing that I'd been bought was the ZX Spectrum 48K. So very, very random. So over to you. What's your either first console you were bought or that you bought? Which would you like to share?
So they are the same. And it was the original Sega Master System. So I had to get a paper round and save up the Master System, and then I went and bought it, and we got the light gun pack.
Excellent.
And that was fantastic. Absolutely love the Master System. We'll die on the hill that Sonic 1 on the Master System is the best version of that game.
Now, the Master System is one of those funny consoles because I loved the design of the first Master System more than I loved the second Master System. And then the second Master System looks much sleeker. Yeah. It looked more like the Mega Drive, It was modern. But that first one, it had what looked like PCB kind of etchings on it, pointing to buttons and things. And that just was cool. That was a design choice. And I was all there for that choice.
Master System 2, it was trying to be the Mega Drive. In terms of looks and like, oh, it's just as good as Mega Drive. No, that's wrong. It was better in many ways. Hi, Dudley from Yesterzine. I know you're going to be listening to that.
That's going to be sampled, isn't it? Let's face it. You're not going to get away from this.
it was just, there was a certain, for me, the Mega Drive was really good, really flashy, like a huge generational leap from the Master System. I keep wanting to say Master Disaster because that's just what we call it. But those old 8-bit systems, there was a certain charm to them. It was like they were battling against the limitations of the system.
Yes.
And when they made something as slick as Sonic 1 on Master System, it was just... it was a work of art, not only in visual terms and audio terms, but just the engineering terms that had to go into that game to make it do what it did. And that's why I'm so enthusiastic about still about the Spectrum and games on that. If you look at a game I go on about far too much on the Spectrum, Starglider.
Yes.
Absolutely amazing what it made the Spectrum do. The 120K version, which came with extra missions that no other version had, just astounding what they made that little Spectrum do.
You could say the same for Frontier Elite.
Yes, yeah, an infinite world in, 64K or 48K of RAM. It, absolutely incredible.
A lot more was done with what they had. And I mean, we'll come to it when we talk about the retro or modern gaming part, because I have a very fixed opinion on that, which is that retro will always win for very specific reasons. But I guess going back to what you were saying about how the Master System and the engineering feats that were involved in making the games, and you could say the same for the NES at this point as well, they were both limited. But good God, did they have good games on them that people will still go back today and say these were what were the core games that you could choose from that led to what we have now.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole Sonic series, let's face it, is still going to this day because of these original games that were released back when. Mm-hmm. And same with Mario. And you can't say a franchise can keep on releasing games like that unless they had a really good start in the world. And these did.
Yeah, sometimes I think that, we've been through an era of modern gaming. Sorry to jump about on this list. But
no, that's fine.
We've been through an era of modern gaming where a lot of games, especially a lot of open world games, are just the same thing. Absolutely packed with, in air quotes, content. Which is just variations on a theme over and over again. So many little side quests that don't really fit, that add nothing to it. And it's kind of, they went, we've got all of these resources now, what should we do? Make it, just make the game world huge, and it'll be fantastic. It's like, no, we're driving around this world for hours, not really advancing the story or doing anything. It's just, there's a lot of places to go. Whereas retro games, they had those limitations and games had to be absolutely super sharp focused in what they wanted to do. And so those concepts were refined so well that you ended up with things like Super Mario 3, which was innovative but not overwhelming. It was sprawling, but you didn't get lost. Really laser focused.
100%. And, let's go to the retro or modern gaming question then. So the question normally is number 5. It's retro or modern gaming, which would you choose? And what I was saying is basically exactly what you've just said. And it's this same argument that Rob and I have had on the Sci-Fi Show, which is why practical effects for us will always beat CGI effects. In practical effects, they look so good because they existed, they're real.
Yes.
And in the retro versus modern gaming, I will always go retro because the honest answer is they had to do so much more with so little, they couldn't afford just to make a bad game. Ridiculous as it sounds, Postman Pat is an incredibly boring game on the ZX Spectrum once you've played it through a few times.
Yeah.
But when you consider, it's an open world, you're driving around, you've got missions. Oh, wait, that sounds exactly like you were saying. It's modern gaming. They've basically gone to modern gaming at that point. But when you then consider games such as The Hobbit or, as you say, with Trash Man or Jet Set Willy, you've got, Cauldron 2 is another prime example, where you've got a giant sprawling map. It's beautifully animated, it's got great artwork in it, but you were limited to a 48K memory, but they made it work. Yet you're right, when you come to the modern gaming world, I've given up with Grand Theft Auto. I loved playing Grand Theft Auto. The first Grand Theft Auto was one of my favourite all-time games. It didn't need to look pretty. It just needed to play well, and that's exactly what it did. Then we got to GTA 2, and ooh, it's a bit prettier, but it's the same game, and I will enjoy that. GTA 3, wow, this is impressive. Still a good game. Then you got GTA 4 and GTA 5, and no doubt GTA 6, and all they're doing at this point is making the game collection missions. Can we make it look really, really pretty? There's no soul to it anymore.
It's filling a map for the sake of it.
Yeah, it's what's the best we can do. And I'm pretty sick now of modern gaming being how pretty can we make a game look? Because honestly, I don't care. I want a game that's got a storyline and it's got things to find. I don't care if it's like the most gloriously photorealistic game out there. If it's got nothing to it, I don't care.
Yeah, because with like the retro and modern gaming question, I would say I love my retro gaming. There are some modern games which I like. Mm-hmm. For instance, the God of War series on PC. God of War Ragnarok. I got a new graphics card and I got the original God of War for PC because I thought it was just going to show off the graphics card and I was going to go, oh, I haven't wasted my money. But then I got into it and the story and, you know, every little collectathon mission actually furthered the story and got you backstory and it was so well done. Those two games are two of my favourite modern games. But
I would argue that the God of War games are closer to film and story than they are a game. Because you're right, everything has a backstory. Every story has its own story. You feel like you are part of the entire thing. You don't feel just like I'm being presented this and it really doesn't matter if I do this.
Agency in a game is a big thing for me. I think my favourite type of game now is where there's games with retro sensibilities and modern niceties, like Shovel Knight.
Yes.
I love the presentation of Shovel Knight. They really have like honed their art style. It's brilliant to control, and yet there's so many modern niceties applied on top of it. And it's, you know, you wouldn't think, this could be a NES game because it's not. It's still got limitations, and they play to the strengths of those limitations, but also applying all the modern tricks we can do now to add that extra sheen of niceness. It's fantastic.
Exactly. Relating it to the SNES, I guess, isn't it? Do it like that, you're not stuck with this is either going to be a standard cartridge or it's going to be one that we've got to get the FX chip involved in.
Yeah.
We now have that ability just to say, let's go back to that era of game and make it how we wanted if we'd released it back then without the limitations of the hardware.
And then you've got stuff like Celeste. Yeah, it's 320 by 180. That's the resolution that game runs in apart from the text. And it's just fantastic. And Dark Side Detective, you know, very much point and click, you are in control of this. Really low resolution graphics, but, you know, those skills have been honed and the technology we've got now to produce those graphics has come on so much. I love that modern retro. That's how I would term those games, and that's my favourite.
No, that's an absolutely fair thing to go with. I mean, the two modern games that I've played most recently, or not most recently, but probably the ones that I've come to the most, weirdly was Goat Simulator 3, because as silly as it sounds, it basically did what all modern games are currently. It was just a giant collectathon. But what they did is they said, you know what, if that's what everyone's doing, let's just rip the piss a little bit. Let's have a lot of fun with this. And they did it, and it was just stupid fun, and you could lose yourself in it. And I spent hours completing it, but it was worth it. And just weird as it is, I'm really glad I did. And then the other one Rob introduced me to is a game called Cult of Lamb. And
I've heard of that. I've not played it, though.
it's incredibly worth it. You play this lovely little lamb and you basically create your own cult, and it's a dungeon crawler. You basically create your cult, you free these woodland creatures who then begin to worship you, and you've got to build them a home. And there's this whole kind of Sim City side of it where you're going around, you're making sure they're happy, they've got work to do, they've got a house, they've got somewhere to sleep, they've got somewhere to come and pray to you at. But then the other side of it is you go to the top of the map and then you're going through this dungeon crawler where it will randomly generate you 10 rooms that you've got to go through and destroy the things in each room. And then eventually you get to the big boss for that, and then there's bigger bosses, and it just keeps going, and it is what you're saying. It is a retro take on a modern game, and it's got flavor and it's got a soul. It's just enjoyable. So I'm absolutely with you on that. Modern gaming as is, I'm not much of a fan of, but when you've put a retro twist on it and you do it well, brilliant.
Go niche, go deep.
100%.
Yeah.
So going back in time then, so going back to your Master System days or even your Speccy days then, what was the game shop you remember most?
Oh boy, it was a shop where in the town where I grew up, which I ended up working in for about a year. And the guy who ran it, his wife died, and apparently as she was dying, she said, "I want you to open a video game shop, because the kids love it and I want to do something nice for the kids in this town."
Okay.
And so he did. He had no interest in video games, knew nothing about it. It wasn't even his main business. His business was selling bingo supplies to working men's clubs, so he didn't even care if it made money. He converted like the ground floor of his house into a shop and just bought and sold secondhand video games.
That's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, he was an awesome guy. And I say he did not care about the money, just wanted to do what his wife wanted. And it absolutely stunk of cigarettes, because he would sit there smoking, chain-smoking constantly.
Oh, so, lovely.
Every time I got a game from there, it would have to be decontaminated on the way home.
What sort of era are we talking? Are we talking Master System era, more modern?
It started in, I think, 92, 93. And it went on till, I think it shut down in 99.
Right, okay. So it wasn't the longest running store, but it got to see some of the best eras. So it got to see Mega Drive, Master System. It got to see things like the Amiga and Atari boxes, no doubt. And then early PC and the PlayStation. That's just an incredible era, because I can even picture it now, just what the show, not even knowing what business it is, but just knowing what the shelves would have looked like and having the games on it, and secondhand games as well. Things like remembering going in and having like a basket in the middle of a room, and it would just be Mega Drive games just all neatly stacked inside that basket that you could just go through, and there'd be 20 copies of Sonic the Hedgehog, and there'd be maybe, you might be lucky and get something like Desert Strike, but it would be all really generic games that everyone got when they first got their console. I can picture it now.
For 50p or something.
Oh, God, that's going to be a memory I need to bring up at some point when I worked at Game, because that's a... I'll bring it up now. Why not? So when I worked at Game was the 99 into year 2000, and obviously there was a lot less care by the company about what was done. So obviously games would come in and it's like, oh, yeah, we'll buy that for 50p from you. And then obviously that would go and sit out the back and one of us would take it home. And if a game came in that no one wanted, it was like, oh, well, we'll say what the computer's offered is correct then. But, oh, so many times. I mean, the person I worked with, I think it was deputy manager called Tom, this bloke walked in with one of these big cardboard kind of vegetable trays, and it had an original NES in, had a load of NES games, and it had the golden cart version of Zelda in it. And he said, oh, well, yeah, it's not on the system, so we can't. But, you know, I'll give you a tenner for it if you want. And I'll help you do your pre-order for the PlayStation 2. And that was it. And then it went out back. He gave it a tenner and he took that home. And it's like, doing that today, CEX and the like would be screaming for a deal like that.
Wow. Yeah.
But You can't get away with it now, obviously. I mean, I'm sure places do try it on, but being able to just say, look, we'll give you 50p or we'll give you £2 trade in to, if you want to trade in towards a pre-order. So silly now. Okay.
Yeah, the internet's kind of put a stop to that, hasn't it?
Just a little bit. I mean, yeah, obviously you get a lot of the scams out there, and Vinted's one of the prime ones. People are putting things up and they're either fake or they never turn up. But that leads us quite nicely onto this question. What's your worst gaming memory, or what was your most let down moment? So take it away. What let you down, or was the worst memory you have?
It was the arcade version of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for the Spectrum. not because the gameplay was bad. The gameplay was fine for a Spectrum game, but it was a multi-load. And if you were decent at the game, you could get through a level in a couple of minutes, and then you'd have to sit and wait 5 minutes for the next level to load in. And it was unplayable. It was just the multi-load absolutely ruined it. I got it on the Plus 3 disc a few years later, and it was brilliant. It was like those levels loaded in seconds. But yeah, the multi-load just killed that game.
Now, I'm trying to remember if that's the one I play. Was that the one that when you went through the sewers and you went back out of the sewer, you kind of had an overworld kind of bit you could walk between?
No, it was side-scrolling beat-em-up.
It was purely just the arcade version?
It was purely the arcade machine, yeah.
Ah, right, okay. Well, that's incredible. And multi-load was like the bane of anyone's existence on the old cassettes. I think the only one we had off the top of my head would have been Operation Wolf. As that was one that was regular. You got through one level, right, now you've got to wait for it to load again.
Yeah.
That or Daily Thompson, actually. If you wanted day two, you had to turn the tape over.
I got that on the pack with my Plus 3, so we had that on disc and it was fine.
Yeah, you see, that's incredibly unfair when you say things like that. Yes.
That was done to my dad because the family friend had a Plus 2. So I was like, can we get a Plus 2? Because I know they're really good. And he's like, no, we're having a Plus 3 because we've got to be better than them. I said, okay, fine, I'll live with it.
Keeping up with the Joneses plus one. That's amazing. Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I guess then that brings us to our last question then. And that is, what would you take to a desert island? If you could take any game, and I said it didn't matter what it was, didn't matter what console, it will always work. You'll always be able to play it whenever you want. What game is it that you would take to that desert island?
Oh.
It's incredibly tough, I know.
It's difficult because there are two that come to mind. And there's... I know which one I'm going to choose, but I want to tell you about both.
No, go for it.
There is a game on the Spectrum called Jungle Trouble, and it's not a very well-known one, but it is absolutely, you know, I talked about that laser-focused refining of concepts, and it is just on a single screen, pure platforming action. Skill-based stuff. I can't quite describe it.
I'm kind of just looking at it now. It's one I'd never come across.
To play. Yes, I love it.
I'd never come across. I'm just looking at the picture of it now. It's very reminiscent of if you took Pitfall from the 2600 and just forced it to be on one screen.
Yes.
So rather than scrolling, it's the level of Pitfall, but on one screen for you to manage.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wonderful. And when I got that, it had 4 skill levels. And I thought, oh, well, you know, to start off with, I'm just going to start on skill level 1. Mm-hmm. For some reason, they'd got it switched around, and 4 was the easiest, and 1 was the most difficult. So I was like, I'm terrible at this. I'm really, really bad. I just can't even get past the first obstacles. And then years later, I discovered, actually, I can start on level 4 and jump over these crocodiles really easily.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's just an amazing single screen platforming action reaction times factor. It's just great. So from that to the other end of the spectrum, Chrono Trigger on the SNES. And that's the one I would take to a desert island. It's fantastic characters. It's a fantastic story. You get side missions that you do actually have an effect on the ending. Decisions that you make halfway through determine who's in your party at the end. And it's just so much fun. It's very, very rare that you end up in a situation in the game where you have to just go and grind levels to progress.
Mm.
It's so well paced and worked out.
Now, if I remember,
something like 13 different endings.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely astounding game.
I've never played it. My closest friend, it was one of his favourite games. Mm. I might be remembering incorrect, but was this one of the ones that also used kind of mode 7 at periods? It really demonstrated the SNES's power. But packed in a huge amount as well. It really, really did give you value for money.
Yeah, the story is epic. And I know people like have overused the word epic, but this truly is. It's stories set across time, space, death and reality. It's great. Definitely my desert island game.
Oh, that sounds an absolutely fantastic choice. Well, those were the six questions. And as I said to you outside of the recording, what I really want you to do now, Nikki, is tell the world about Quantum Witch. Because as much as people may have come across it on social media, they may have seen various people who talk about it. And you've heard Mr. Biffo in episode 2 of this, if you've listened. Him say about his small part he's played, but even he said, my part that I've played in this has been so tiny, and it really has just been helping Nikki hone in what she already had in her mind for this. So please tell us all about Quantum Witch, where they can find it, what it is, and just get more information out there for us.
So I've got to correct before a little bit there. I did have this all worked out. But he really showed me how to take all these various ideas and story beats and characters and put them into something that actually told a story.
Okay.
Because it actually started as a short story, and then I tried to make it into a novel and found, no, I'm really bad at writing novels, so I'm not going to do that. And I thought, let's do a retro point-and-click adventure. And a few months into that, I remembered, it's really easy to make a terrible point-and-click adventure when nothing makes sense and it's really boring, and unless you're thinking exactly the same way as the author was, you just can't progress. So I decided to make it not so much a platformer. It is a platformer. You jump on platforms and there are some platforming puzzles, but it's really a plotformer in that the story is driven by your choices. So people have seen, you might have seen around social media, if you just go to Steam, search Quantum Witch, you'll find it there. There's a small demo, about 20 minutes worth of the game, just to get you introduced to the world. And it's very retro styled, 320 by 180 resolution. Yay. Apart from the text, which I've allowed myself 640 by 480 for the texts.
Ooh.
Oh, luxury pixels.
Whoa, you're spoiling us. You are spoiling us.
Yeah. So people see it and they go, oh, that's some nice retro pixel arts, and it's a platformer. Yeah, there are 10 million retro pixel art platformers out there, and they skip by. And then they play the demo and they go, oh, this isn't what I expected. I'll tell you how I found out. I thought maybe I'm onto something worth investing in here. I thought I'd go to some indie game PR companies and see what they thought. And lots of them just looked at the screenshots and said, there are millions of these. We're not going to be able to make this stand out. Sorry. It's a no. And then one of them said, yeah, it's possible that, with polish and time in this, it could stand out and stand a chance of making your money back. And then they went and played the demo and they said, we need a call with you. I said, okay, what's happened? I got to the call and they said, we've never played anything like this before. This isn't a platformer.
Mm-hmm.
This is a choose-your-own-adventure book in packaged up as a retro game. And there don't seem to be any decisions that are throwaway. Yeah, you never know what is going to come back at some point in the future in the story and say, ah, you did this, and therefore this has happened. I said, yeah, that's how it is. Consequences, actions, agency is a big thing for me in games.
Mm-hmm.
There are 6 or 7 different endings for the main storyline. And I'm not talking, Mass Effect 3. Oh, there's 6 or 7 different colours your spaceship can be.
Ooh, like, wow.
I'm talking like, the entire world can be destroyed in one ending, or you save everyone in another, or somewhere in between. Or maybe you become a god and ascend and leave everything behind. Maybe you rescue the cute robot, and maybe you don't. And
I mean, I'm looking at the Steam page now, and this is what made me think I must get you on here. I absolutely love this bit here. Choices matter. Convince a character to wear something, they'll wear it for the rest of the game. It's just an absolutely wonderful idea that you've just gone and you've run with the whole idea of, I'm not just going to make it very simple. I'm not just going to make it, there's the ending. I'm not going to just make it, these are the fixed choices you have, and really it's a bit linear. You can go to the choices in whatever order you want, but it's going to always be the same. You've really put the effort into making this just a all-out spectacular.
It's not the longest game to play through, although I say that as someone who's playing it through knowing exactly where everything is. Average playthrough time for the demo has been about 30 minutes, which is quite a long time for how much content is actually in the demo. There's only about 10 screens in the demo you can visit. But some people have played it for nearly 4 hours, just exploring it. And I'm like, wow. So the full game is, I can go through it in about 45 minutes, speedrunning it, knowing exactly where everything is, and not bothering to do some of the side missions. So it's bigger than I think sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only one path through the game.
And there will always be people that will go and speedrun a game. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. There will always be someone that goes out and says, look, how fast you can complete Mario 64. And what I say to that is, yeah, it's a really good party trick. But have you actually played Mario 64? Because it's bloody brilliant. All the things you can find within that alone. So I'm going to say the same about Quantum Witch. And the worst thing about this is that obviously you're saying it as the creator. You know everything about the game already. But the people listening, I don't think they're going to be thinking the same thing you are here. And I think it's doing a big disservice to the game.
Yeah, maybe that's what my friends tell me. Just said, look, you've got the 1,000-watt light bulb. You know everything and you can see everything.
Mm.
There are people who've played your demo for 4 hours just exploring. And there's only 10 screens in the demo. And there's at least 4 times that in the full version. And then once you've completed it, all the choices you didn't make, you can start again and go and see what would have happened if you chose differently. Like the demo ends with you deciding whether to rescue a character or not. And that's the first big story beat of the game. And the story for that character and the repercussions for the rest of the story are huge. So that's what I wanted to make. You're thinking about Trash Man again. It's like, do I go and help the person or do I go and run after the truck?
Yeah.
Changes the rest of the game. That was what I wanted to do. And
I think that's a really important thing that you've done, because so many games don't have replayability anymore. Grand Theft Auto, and sorry, Rockstar, that I come back to attack you again. Grand Theft Auto 4, for example, I stopped playing, not because it wasn't a good game, but because you kept making me go and see my cousin or go and see my girlfriend. The bloody phone would ring. Yes. Right, you've got to go bowling with this person. No, piss off. I killed them three times already. Why are they back alive? I don't want that. Whereas this genuinely feels like the choices I make will stay with me. And yes. then, like you say, then when I come to play it again in, let's say, 6 months' time or a year's time, I'll go and I'm going to download it again. Brilliant. Ah, I chose that last time. Let's not do that. And those are so important. And the fact that you've made it so there's so many endings, I think there's something to really be proud of. And I'm really, really looking forward to its release. Is it still aiming for June 25?
June is, yeah, we're aiming for Pride Month because it's quite a lot of queer themes in the game as well.
Well, yeah, and again, really, really love the comment there from Internet Man, a bunch of woke nonsense. It's got women in it.
I think on the...
It's so wonderful.
We've got Steph Sterling involved as well.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, there was a one of the old gods of the world that I'd written a profile for and a rough story outline. And I thought Steph Sterling would just write this perfectly. So she's involved. And they featured it on their podcast. And it's amazing when you release something like that, to hear what people think, because they latch onto things that you thought were little silly throwaway things. But there is a character in it called the Skeleton Who Can See Through Time.
Yes.
And they have their own theme tune and they dance to the theme tune. And they are the game's hint system. So if you don't know what to do, you've forgotten where you are, you go to the skeleton who can see through time. They can see through time and they know where you should go next.
That's a wonderful mechanic. That's absolutely fantastic.
And one of the guys on, it was Conrad Zimmerman on Steph Sterling's podcast said, I never use hint systems in these games, but I keep going back to the skeleton to see what the skeleton's going to say next. And there's a character later on in the game in the bit I'm finishing off now called Clippers. And I don't like to boast, but I think Clippers is the cutest robot that's ever existed. So it's like Emma saw it and went, oh my God, what have you done? So what do you mean? She said, well, this is going to be a huge thing. People will see Clippers and go, Clippers must have their own game. I don't care about the rest. I just want Clippers.
And just think, yeah. If you'd released this back in the year of 95, you would have had it on a big box CD. It would have come on a big box. It would have come on floppy disk and CD. You would have included a Windows 95 kind of background and theme pack that would have also been, you could have had a Clippers theme and background, or even the virtual pet, like pets or cats or whatever it could have been on your screen. And
there is a website, it's quantumwit.ch.
Okay.
And it's as if it's like the main character of the game has made her own GeoCities site.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I love it. It's got a link to the Steam store and everything like that.
I will add all of this data, obviously, to the metadata of the podcast. So if you need any of this, head over to the description. You'll find everything to do with Quantum Witch, the show, Nikki as well. We'll put all your social media on there. But I'm looking on this now and it is straight up GeoCities.
It's GeoCities.
Back in the day of like, oh, where did you get your web space from? Oh, I got it from FreeServe because I got a CD in the post. That is absolutely beautiful. And yet there you go, there's our skeleton who can see through time. And the cow is particularly cute, by the way.
Yes. We've already had some requests for plushy cows.
That doesn't surprise me in the slightest. And I think what I've got to say, and the last bit I will say on this, because obviously I want people to just come and follow you, find the game themselves as well. I remember seeing the early days of this and seeing you working on the running animation and looking at what it is now in the clips. It's such good animation. You've put so much effort into it and it's absolutely paid off. It looks so fluid. Thanks. And... It's amazing. It really is an amazing piece of work.
I mean, it's all hand-drawn. There are some, there's a CRT shader effect as well in the game, which is done to actually enhance the graphics rather than just look like a CRT, and it's pretty good. But yeah, it's all hand-drawn, no AI. Very little real intelligence either. So.
Yeah, well, I must admit that, again, for those of you that don't remember what gaming's like and you've only ever seen emulators, stick a CRT shader on and you'll see what those creators of that original pixel art in games, like even down to Sonic, you'll suddenly see how dithering and that CRT shader shows you what we grew up with and why we are so fond of it, rather than it being very flat and boring. And it is a glorious looking thing. And Nikki, I'm just really pleased to just have you on here talking about it.
I mean, there is one effect towards the end of the game which does break the 320 by 180 rule.
Okay.
It did it on purpose for the plot. And that's all I'm going to say about it.
Right. I will look forward to seeing that. So, realising that we're nearly coming up to an hour...
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
I know, it's gone amazingly quickly. Where can people find you, Nikki? So, if they want to follow you and see your social posts, where's the best place?
So, I am on Blue Sky, NikkiJ.games on Blue Sky. And that's basically it. I don't do much of the social media now. There is a Discord for Quantum Witch, if you're interested, which I believe is linked from the website. If not, it should be.
Yeah, and again, we'll make sure that's all in the metadata for when people need it. Yeah. And that's it. Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking part, Nikki. It's really appreciated.
Delight.
And anyone that's listening to this, as I say, if that sounds like your cup of tea, a game, and it really should be, because it is... It's looking to be absolutely, a word that Nikki used earlier, it is looking to be absolutely epic. Please, please, please go and get it on your wish list and go and buy it when it comes out. And if there's any sort of fundraising that ends up being done to get a publisher to take it on for things like Switch, PlayStation and so on, please let us know and we'll make sure we share it.
Well, thanks. I mean, I think like if it's a success on PC, then publishers will get in. It's difficult at the moment because they just look at it and see a retro platformer. But hopefully I've gone niche, I've gone deep, and hopefully it'll find its audience.
Fingers crossed. Well, I am going to let you disappear, so I'm going to kick stop recording. Ladies and gents, if you enjoyed this show, you can go and listen to the other Retro Rambles. We've got future ones coming up as well. You can find out more about us on channel84.co.uk. The Variety Show is listed there. And you can find all our social media bits on there too. So thank you very much. Nikki, thank you very much. And we'll take it easy. Goodbye.
Bye.
This was a Studio Channel 84 network show. To find more, head over to channel84.co.uk now.